In April 1865, as the Civil War ended, two boys from vastly different worlds were about to embark on journeys that would transform America. One was born on a pile of rags in a Virginia slave cabin with just a single name, Booker. The other watched Abraham Lincoln's funeral procession from his grandfather's Manhattan window, young Theodore Roosevelt. Neither could have imagined how their paths would intersect to challenge America's racial boundaries. Their partnership would become one of history's most consequential yet unlikely friendships. A former slave and a privileged New Yorker united by uncommon courage and conviction. As Mark Twain later observed after meeting both men, each started at the bottom, each worked his way up by his own efforts, each achieved great things. Their story remains one of America's most fascinating yet underappreciated historical relationships, one that continues to resonate in our ongoing national conversation about race, opportunity, and leadership. Born into slavery around 1856, Booker had no surname, no education, and no apparent future beyond servitude. His crude cabin near Hales Ford, Virginia, featured a dirt floor, no windows, and a door that barely kept out the elements. While his mother Jane cooked for the Burroughs plantation, young Booker carried water to field workers, occasionally catching glimpses of the mysterious schoolhouse where white children learned to read, something forbidden to enslaved people. When Union soldiers arrived in April 1865, 9-year-old Booker witnessed a transformative moment as a stranger read the Emancipation Proclamation. Though he couldn't fully comprehend its meaning, his mother's tears of joy made clear that something momentous had occurred. Freedom brought both opportunity and responsibility as the family journeyed nearly 200 miles west to reunite with Booker's stepfather in West Virginia's Kanawha Valley. There, harsh reality quickly replaced liberation's initial euphoria. Booker and his brother John worked grueling pre-dawn shifts at salt furnaces, later moving to coal mines where conditions were even more dangerous. Yet amid this hardship, Booker discovered something precious, his first exposure to written language when he learned to recognize the numbers 18 marked on salt barrels. This sparked an insatiable hunger for education. If I accomplished nothing else in life, he resolved, I would in some way get enough education to enable me to read common books and newspapers. When finally permitted to attend school part-time, he needed a surname for the roll call. Without hesitation, he declared himself Booker Washington, taking his first step toward creating his identity. His breakthrough came when hired as houseboy for Viola Knapp Ruffner, a former Vermont schoolteacher married to a wealthy coal mine owner. Unlike previous employers who viewed black workers as inherently lazy, Mrs. Ruffner recognized Booker's potential. Her exacting standards, demanding absolute cleanliness, punctuality, and honesty, weren't cruelty but opportunity. As he met her expectations, she allowed him to attend school and tutored him at home. He never needed correction or the word hurry or come, for he was always ready for his book, she recalled. Under her guidance, Booker shed his plantation dialect, gained fluency in speaking and writing, and developed the disciplined work ethic that would define his life. By 16, Booker's determination had crystallized into a singular goal, attending Hampton Normal and Agricultural Institute, a school for freed people 400 miles away. In September 1872, with just $12 in his pocket, much of it donated by his brother John and other formerly enslaved people who saw in his education their own hopes for advancement, he set off on foot. When his money ran out in Richmond, he slept under a boardwalk and unloaded ships to earn his keep before completing the journey. At Hampton, Booker thrived under the military-like discipline and practical education philosophy of General Samuel Chapman Armstrong, who believed that establishing industrious habits was the foundation for character development. Unlike the classical education emphasized at white universities, Hampton focused on practical skills and industrial training that graduates would use to teach African-American children. Teacher Natalie Nord recognized Booker's unusual gift for public speaking and helped develop it, introducing him to the writings of Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass. This education would transform the barefoot boy from a slave cabin into America's most influential black leader. While Booker Washington struggled for basic education, Theodore Roosevelt enjoyed privileges of wealth and family connections, yet faced his own formidable challenges. Born October 27, 1858, to a prominent New York family, young Teddy was plagued by debilitating asthma, fevers, and chronic illness. His frail health confined him to home education and threatened to limit his future. When Theodore was 14, his father delivered a pivotal challenge. You have the mind, but you have not the body. Without the help of the body, the mind cannot go as far as it should. The boy responded with characteristic determination. I'll make my body. He embarked on a rigorous program of lifting weights, wrestling, and boxing, a regimen he would maintain throughout his life. This early lesson in overcoming physical limitations through sheer willpower would shape Roosevelt's famous strenuous life philosophy. Despite his northern upbringing, Roosevelt had southern roots through his mother, Martha Mitty Bullock, who grew up on a Georgia plantation. While young Teddy prayed for Union victory, his mother's brothers fought for the Confederacy. This divided heritage gave Roosevelt unique perspective on America's regional divisions and may have contributed to his later interest in national reconciliation. At Harvard, Roosevelt discovered his intellectual gifts, devouring books on history and natural science. When his beloved father died suddenly in February 1878, the devastated 20-year-old wrote in his diary that part of my life had been taken away, and resolved, with the help of my God, I will try to lead such a life as he would have wished. This loss accelerated Roosevelt's maturation and ambition. After graduating, Roosevelt married Alice Hathaway Lee and began studying at Columbia Law School while nurturing his growing fascination with military history. This interest produced his first book, The Naval War of 1812, published when Roosevelt was just 23. The scholarly work, still referenced by naval historians today, revealed Roosevelt's intellectual rigor and foreshadowed his later interest in naval preparation. Tragedy struck again in February 1884 when both his mother and wife died on the same day, his wife from kidney failure after childbirth and his mother from typhoid fever. In his diary, Theodore wrote simply, "The light has gone out of my life." Leaving his infant daughter in his sister's care, the grieving Roosevelt retreated to the Dakota Territory, where he established Elkhorn Ranch and immersed himself in the rugged Western lifestyle. Though not naturally skilled at ranching, he beavered down 17 trees compared to his Maine workers 50-plus. Roosevelt participated fully in cattle roundups and hunting expeditions, once coolly shooting a 9-foot grizzly bear between the eyes from just 25 feet away. The Dakota experience transformed him physically and mentally, earning him respect from skeptical cowboys and providing material for his Western writings. When he returned to New York politics, he brought with him a broader understanding of American life beyond the privileged Eastern establishment. In May 1881, Booker Washington received an opportunity that would define his life's work. Three commissioners from Alabama sought Hampton's recommendation for someone to lead a new school for training black teachers in Tuskegee. When General Armstrong recommended Washington, surprising the commissioners who had assumed no qualified black candidate existed, a new chapter began. Washington arrived in Tuskegee on June 24, 1881, to find only a legislative bill allocating $2,000 for teacher salaries. No buildings, no equipment, no land. The school existed merely on paper. With help from Lewis Adams, a skilled craftsman born into slavery who had secured the school's establishment by leveraging black votes, Washington began recruiting students and securing facilities. They purchased a 100-acre abandoned plantation outside town for $500, borrowing the down payment from Hampton's treasurer. Washington insisted the property be deeded to Tuskegee's trustees rather than to himself personally, establishing the institution's independence. He then established a labor-basis curriculum where students studied academics half the day and then worked improving the property. Leading by example, axe on shoulder, he cleared 20 acres for cotton planting. By March 1882, enrollment had grown to 112 students, and they laid the cornerstone for Porter Hall, their first proper building. Washington established a brickyard to create permanent structures and provide vocational training, though the venture failed 3 times before succeeding, a story he would later tell as a moral lesson about perseverance. Washington's vision extended beyond mere academics. He wanted Tuskegee to produce graduates who could support themselves through skilled trades while educating others. The school expanded to include practical training in farming, brickmaking, carpentry, printing, and blacksmithing for men, with housekeeping and sewing for women. His brother John Henry Washington joined in 1885, becoming invaluable as he built a sawmill, managed the expanding farm, and solved infrastructure problems. This progress occurred against a backdrop of deteriorating race relations. As Democrats regained power in Southern legislatures, they passed Jim Crow laws replacing Reconstruction-era progress. Alabama's new constitution criminalized interracial marriage and mandated segregated schools. Washington had to maintain a careful balance, advancing Tuskegee's interests without provoking hostile white neighbors, especially after witnessing the lynching of Jack Turner, a prosperous, independent black farmer and political leader executed on fabricated charges in August 1882. Despite these challenges, Washington found Northern support during fundraising trips, where he was surprised to find hotels would rent him rooms and donors readily opened their doors. By 1895, enrollment would approach 800 students across 20 buildings on 1,810 acres, making Tuskegee one of the most successful educational institutions in the South, black or white. While Washington built Tuskegee, Roosevelt was forging his own path to national prominence. After returning from Dakota, he plunged into New York politics, joining the 21st District Republican Association despite warnings from well-born friends about the rough company he would keep. With support from Irish-born postal worker Joe Murray, Roosevelt won election to the state legislature in November 1881. His transformation into a true reformer came after touring tenement sweatshops with labor leader Samuel Gompers. Seeing families working 16 to 18 hours daily in squalid conditions where they also ate and slept, Roosevelt was moved to champion legislation outlawing cigar making in tenements. Though the bill failed in the state Senate, this marked the beginning of Roosevelt's lifelong commitment to using government power to protect vulnerable citizens. In 1889, President Benjamin Harrison appointed Roosevelt to the Civil Service Commission, where he transformed the sleepy agency into an aggressive watchdog. Fighting the entrenched spoil system, where government jobs went to political loyalists, Roosevelt pushed to expand merit-based hiring beyond the existing 25% of federal positions. He investigated corruption in customs houses and post offices, generating headlines by naming corrupt officials regardless of party affiliation. Roosevelt believed the system should be democratic, arguing that the farmer's lad and the mechanic's son, who had no one to speak for them, should have the same shot as the privileged. His next reform battlefield was the New York Police Department, which he joined as commissioner in 1895. Confronting a department rife with corruption, a recent report had documented millions in kickbacks from brothels, gambling operations, and saloons, Roosevelt conducted unannounced night patrols with journalist Jacob Riis, whose book How the Other Half Lives had deeply moved him. During these inspections, they often found officers missing from their posts, or in one memorable confrontation, sitting in bars instead of patrolling. Roosevelt's national profile rose dramatically in 1898 when, as Assistant Secretary of the Navy, he positioned himself to participate in the Spanish-American War. Despite his wife Edith's concerns following the birth of their son Quentin, Roosevelt resigned his Navy post to volunteer for military service. When offered command of the 1st United States Volunteer Cavalry, he surprisingly declined the colonel rank, suggesting instead that the more experienced Leonard Wood take command while he served as lieutenant colonel, a rare moment of humility that revealed Roosevelt's practical side. The unit soon gained its famous nickname, Roosevelt's Rough Riders. Training at San Antonio's fairgrounds, Roosevelt recruited a diverse force, including fellow clubmen from elite Eastern schools, Southwestern cowboys, and Native Americans. After less than a month of training, they shipped out to Tampa and then to Cuba, where Roosevelt would experience his defining moment of courage under fire. At the Battle of San Juan Heights on July 1, 1898, Roosevelt transformed from politician to war hero. When orders finally came after hours of waiting under Spanish fire, Roosevelt sprang onto his horse and led what he later called his crowded hour. Though initially riding in the rear, as colonels were expected to do, Roosevelt soon took charge when he found other units sheltering below the Spanish entrenchments. "I waved my hat," he recalled, "and we went up the hill with a rush." Despite bullets nicking his elbow and wounding his horse, Roosevelt rode on, the only mounted man on the battlefield, and the most obvious target. War correspondent Richard Harding Davis reported that Roosevelt, charging the rifle pits at a gallop and quite alone, inspired men to follow what looked like foolhardiness, but actually set the pace for the attack. After capturing Kettle Hill, Roosevelt led his men across to join the assault on San Juan Hill. The combined force of white and black regulars and Rough Rider volunteers secured both hills, with Roosevelt later reflecting that all men who feel any power of joy in battle know what it is like when the wolf rises in the heart. The Rough Riders returned to America as heroes, and Roosevelt's military fame catapulted him to the New York governorship in November 1898. His leadership of a diverse fighting force, Harvard men and Confederate generals, cowboys and Native Americans, black men and white men, had made his political rise seem inevitable. As Roosevelt's star rose in politics, Washington faced a pivotal moment of his own. In 1895, after successfully testifying before Congress to secure funding for the Cotton States and International Exposition, Washington received an extraordinary invitation to speak at the exposition's opening ceremonies in Atlanta, becoming the first African American ever to address a racially mixed Southern audience. With just 3 weeks to prepare, Washington faced an extraordinary challenge, advancing black interests while appeasing white Southerners who largely viewed black people as a restless, trifling, insolent, crime-loving class. He labored over multiple drafts, determined to make my remarks of service to the exposition and to both races in the South. When Washington entered the packed exposition hall, the crowd's reaction revealed the racial tensions of 1895. While dignitaries received enthusiastic applause, Washington's appearance caused an instant cessation of the applause and a sudden chill. Standing in a shaft of sunlight that seemed to spotlight him, Washington began speaking in his characteristically confident, conversational style. He opened by acknowledging black Americans as one-third of the South's population and expressing hope that the exposition would cement friendships between races. Then he shared his famous ship parable, a vessel lost at sea signaling desperately for water, receiving only the puzzling response, "Cast down your bucket where you are." When the captain finally complied, he discovered fresh river water all around. Washington applied this lesson to both races. Black Southerners should cultivate friendly relations with the Southern white man and seek opportunity in their homeland, while white Southerners should recognize the loyal workforce who have proved their loyalty to you in the past, in nursing your children, watching by the sickbed of your mothers and fathers. The speech climaxed with Washington's iconic hand gesture, fingers spread above his head, declaring, "In all things that are purely social, we can be as separate as the fingers, yet one as the hand in all things essential to mutual progress." This quintessential Washington compromise, accepting segregation while requesting economic opportunity, electrified the audience. When he concluded by expressing hope for a new heaven and earth in the South, the crowd erupted in thunderous applause. The speech catapulted Washington to national prominence. President Cleveland sent congratulations, newspapers nationwide published his words, and crowds gathered at train stations to see him on his journey home. The Atlanta Constitution declared it an epoch-making talk that marked a turning point in the progress of the Negro race. Not everyone embraced Washington's approach, however. W.E.B. Du Bois, a brilliant young scholar who had studied at Fisk University, Harvard, and in Europe, initially praised Washington's word fitly spoken, but would soon become his chief critic. Where Washington faced the harsh realities of the South as a former slave, Du Bois had experienced relative equality in the North and abroad. This fundamental difference in experience would eventually lead to their philosophical divide. With Du Bois advocating for immediate political rights and classical education, while Washington counseled patience and gradual economic advancement. When William McKinley and Theodore Roosevelt won the 1900 election, Washington sent congratulations, prompting Roosevelt to invite him north. They met briefly at New York's Century Club, with Roosevelt eyeing Southern strategy for a potential 1904 presidential run. Washington's autobiography, Up from Slavery, was gaining acclaim, even impressing the Roosevelts, who recognized in Washington a kindred, self-made spirit despite their vastly different backgrounds. Everything changed on September 6, 1901, when President McKinley was shot by anarchist Leon Czolgosz while greeting visitors at Buffalo's Pan American Exposition. After McKinley's condition initially improved, Roosevelt retreated to the Adirondacks, only to receive urgent news on September 13th that the president had taken a dramatic turn for the worse. After a midnight ride through muddy roads requiring two horse changes, Roosevelt learned McKinley had died. He took the oath of office in Buffalo on September 14th, becoming, at 42, the youngest president in American history. Overnight, Roosevelt faced vast new responsibilities. Though he could no longer visit Tuskegee as planned, he immediately wrote to Washington on his first day as president, seeking to maintain their connection and discuss Southern appointments. When Washington arrived for their 9 p.m. meeting, Roosevelt outlined his approach. He would select only the highest type of Southern white men, regardless of political consequences, while appointing qualified black men of ability and character who had earned their neighbors' respect. Most significantly, he promised to appoint black officials to Northern offices, a nearly unprecedented commitment. When Roosevelt heard Washington would be in town again, he casually dictated a dinner invitation for 7:30 p.m. on October 16, 1901. Though he briefly hesitated because of his color, Roosevelt quickly dismissed this concern as shameful. When Washington received the envelope marked Executive Mansion, he too felt a moment of unease. Despite dining with white families across the North, Washington recognized this was different. The White House in a Southern city could provoke outrage. Setting aside his misgivings, he politely accepted. The dinner itself was an intimate family affair with Edith Roosevelt and the president's younger children. After dinner, Roosevelt and Washington retired to the Red Room to discuss Southern appointments until about 10 o'clock, when Washington departed to catch a night train to New York. Neither man could have anticipated the firestorm this simple meal would ignite. Before Washington even reached New York the next morning, news of the dinner was spreading across the nation, sparked by a brief 2 a.m. Associated Press dispatch. The reaction, particularly from Southern newspapers, was swift and furious. Roosevelt was shocked by the Southern outrage, finding it literally inexplicable and melancholy. While some Northern papers defended the dinner, Southern publications were vicious. The Nashville American called it a breach of good taste, while the Memphis News Scimitar declared it the greatest outrage ever perpetrated by any U.S. citizen. Senator Pitchfork Ben Tillman warned it would necessitate killing 1,000 NERs in the South before they will learn their place again. Overnight, Roosevelt went from calling himself half a Southerner to becoming the most despised president below the Mason-Dixon line since Lincoln. Though he privately vowed to have Washington to dine as often as I please, the political damage was done, forcing Roosevelt to postpone his planned Southern tour. Washington maintained public silence despite being pursued by reporters and receiving countless threatening letters. While some black Americans praised him as a hero of the Negro race, others accused him of being used as a tool or cat's paw. Southern whites directed their anger at Roosevelt, as evidenced when a Florida farmer told Washington he was the greatest man in the country, but Roosevelt was a black scoundrel for inviting him to dinner. Despite the backlash, Roosevelt refused to let the controversy distract him from his broader agenda. In his first annual message to Congress, he outlined two key priorities: the Square Deal for domestic policy, controlling corporations and conserving natural resources, and the Big Stick for international affairs. He also remained committed to his promises to Washington regarding appointing black men to federal offices, a commitment that would prove challenging to fulfill. Roosevelt's nomination of Dr. William Demosthenes Crum as collector of customs at Charleston fulfilled a promise to Washington, but sparked fierce opposition. Despite Crum's impressive credentials, medical degree from Howard, successful practice, head of Charleston's black hospital, Southern opposition was fierce. The Charleston News and Courier objected solely because he is a colored man. Roosevelt refused to back down, using recess appointments to keep Crum in office when the Senate wouldn't confirm him. Similarly, when Minnie Cox, the first black female postmistress in America, faced threats in Indianola, Mississippi after a racist gubernatorial candidate inflamed local sentiment, Roosevelt refused to accept her resignation. Instead, he closed the Indianola post office entirely, creating a national standoff that lasted nearly a year. These battles represented just two of many conflicts, as Roosevelt's reputation as a friend to black Americans became a political liability. Democratic candidates exploited this connection, with one Alabama congressional candidate repeatedly denouncing Washington as the Negro patronage boss, a half-truth that reinforced white paranoia about racial equality. 5 years after his initial promise, Theodore Roosevelt finally visited Booker T. Washington's Tuskegee Institute in October 1905. Despite the chilly weather, thousands gathered to glimpse the president, though security remained tight after previous threats against Washington. Roosevelt marveled at Tuskegee's remarkable growth, from 30 students to 1,500, exceeding Harvard's enrollment, with 33 buildings and $1 million endowment. After reviewing an impressive parade showcasing student skills across 61 floats, Roosevelt delivered a speech Washington had helped shape, addressing racial harmony and education. Though deeply impressed, declaring the school a great focus of civilization, Roosevelt couldn't stay for lunch. Both men understood the political dangers. While Southern bigots posed the greatest physical danger to Washington, a different threat emerged from educated Northern black intellectuals who challenged his leadership approach. W.E.B. Du Bois's landmark book, The Souls of Black Folk, published in 1903, directly criticized Washington's accommodationist approach, famously describing black Americans' two-ness and advocating for the talented 10th to receive classical education rather than trade training. In August 1906, Du Bois founded the Niagara Movement, gathering educated black activists at Harper's Ferry, where John Brown had led his famous raid. Unlike Washington's accommodationist approach, Du Bois demanded true equality, declaring they must struggle for their rights unceasingly, and if they fail, die trying. Though the Niagara Movement disbanded years later, its members formed the core of the newly established NAAPC, ensuring that Washington now had to share the American stage with Du Bois. The limits of Roosevelt and Washington's partnership were severely tested that same year by the Brownsville Affair. When black soldiers of the 25th Infantry were blamed for a shooting incident in Brownsville, Texas, despite inconclusive evidence, Roosevelt ordered all 167 soldiers dishonorably discharged without trial, the only mass punishment in U.S. Army history. Despite Washington's personal plea to reconsider, Roosevelt remained unmoved. This decision divided the nation along racial lines. Southern newspapers celebrated it as the most praiseworthy thing the president has done, while the black press universally condemned it. Mark Twain privately fumed that Roosevelt acted in a shabby and dishonest and dishonorable way to get back into Southern favor after the Washington dinner controversy. Though Washington could have viewed this as a betrayal, he characteristically avoided burning bridges, explaining to a friend that the colored people of this country cannot afford to place themselves in continued opposition to the President of the United States, no matter who he is. The Brownsville affair marked both a black mark on Roosevelt's reputation and the effective end of the productive partnership between Roosevelt and Washington in advancing racial justice. As Roosevelt's presidency drew to a close, his meetings and correspondence with Washington became less frequent. Before leaving office in 1908, Roosevelt thanked Washington for recommending men of high character for positions. Washington hoped to continue his advisory role with Roosevelt's successor, William Howard Taft, but Taft made clear he would roll back Roosevelt's already wavering commitment to black appointments. In autumn 1915, Washington's health deteriorated severely. After nearly collapsing in New York, he was diagnosed with Bright's disease, kidney failure. Despite warnings he might not survive the journey, Washington insisted on returning to Tuskegee, declaring, "I was born in the South, have lived all my life in the South, and expect to die and be buried in the South." He died at 4:45 a.m. on November 14, 1915, at age 59. Theodore Roosevelt outlived Booker by 3 years, struggling with his diminished status. Though he wanted to run for president in 1916 and later sought to raise a division when America entered World War I, neither opportunity materialized. Instead, all four of his sons entered military service, with his youngest son Quentin dying in aerial combat over France in 1918, a loss from which Theodore never recovered. On January 5, 1919, after complaining to Edith of an odd feeling that his heart might stop, Theodore died in his sleep at 4:15 a.m. from a coronary embolism. The two men shared remarkable parallels despite their vastly different backgrounds. Both had ambitious goals from childhood, suffered the death of their first wives, emerged as national leaders, worshipped Abraham Lincoln, and confronted American racism in their own ways. They formed a mutual admiration society, with Booker consistently supportive of his friend, while Theodore repeatedly praised Washington. Roosevelt initiated their relationship seeking Booker's advice, partly for political reasons, but also from his genuine desire to do right. He viewed slavery as morally indefensible and worried about the resurgence of racism threatening social order. Washington saw in Roosevelt a pathway to change, using their connection to place talented black people and fair-minded whites in positions of authority. Though Roosevelt's equality beliefs were limited by his Darwinist views on racial evolution, he recognized Washington as exceptional. Together, they challenged assumptions and secured unprecedented appointments for black men, though their victories remained limited by the constraints of their era. Roosevelt underestimated the risks of associating with a black man and was shocked by the prolonged backlash from their White House dinner. Years later, he admitted it was a mistake that was misinterpreted by the white men of the South and by the black men of the South. The dinner incident colored every subsequent racial decision of his presidency, possibly influencing his infamous Brownsville Buffalo Soldiers decision. Though America has made remarkable progress, racial equality remains a work in progress. Roosevelt and Washington, despite their imperfections, were men of virtue who worked together to advance Lincoln's vision of a more perfect union. Their toughness in the face of vicious criticism helped make America the most successful multicultural nation in the world, an ongoing project that continues to challenge us today.